Blog Talk Radio.
I want all privately owned radios to be immediately impounded.
Yes, sir.
Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Kansas.
Well, there is such a place, Toto.
There must be. Not a place you can get to via boat or a train. Far, far away. Behind the moon. Beyond the rain.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an announcement.
I can no longer sit back and allow the conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Let's talk about
creeping like a communist. It's knocking at our doors, voraciously devouring the way things are today. Savagely deflowering the
official story.
Yeah. Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Radio Free Kansas.
Madness.
Why should you put your hands, G.I.?
Now, why don't you just take it easy? Please make me a drink of grain alcohol and rainwater and help yourself to whatever you'd like.
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Kansas.
Ear to the ground, voice in the air. Worldwide.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed.
Radio Free Kansas.
I've washed away all my sins and transgressions.
You can listen in.
Good afternoon, listeners. It's a little late startup today. A late startup, but it's not a bad day. It's a continuing drought. However, The computers are telling us that we can expect some rain in a couple days. I've heard it before, you know. This is a broadcast that originally aired on Dialogue Works, and I've embedded the link to this guy's YouTube channel because he has a lot of good. He recently had my Professor Michael Hudson of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He's had all kinds of people pertaining to peace, and it's just a one. It really is a great channel. And I happen to know, I've been watching, and Ray McGovern has appeared. Now, this is not his latest. He just came on today on Dialogue Works. You could just go to YouTube and do a search, Dialogue Works, or well, that's what you do, and it'll take you right to the channel. I recently subscribed. I've been watching it on the home TV. But I decided to make a show about this because it's some big stuff. I mean, and Ray McGovern, my favorite anti-war veteran for peace, he came to, you know, here's his bio that's published. I'll tell you more about him if you want. Ray McGovern, he came to Washington from his native Bronx in the early 60s, which is, ironically enough, where our phone system operates out of here at Blog Talk Radio in my virtual studio. And he served in the Army in the early 60s and then as a CIA analyst for 27 years, from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush, Bush 1. And he chaired Mr. McGovern chaired the National Intelligence Estimates, prepared the presidential daily brief, and he spoke one-on-one many times with President Ronald Reagan, his most senior national security advisor from 1981 to 85. And Ray, Mr. McGovern, has appeared on Radio Free Kansas numerous times. So first we got to do the news, the world news and brief from the United Nations, and then we'll go right into Ray McGovern visiting at Dialogue Works.
This is the news and brief from the United Nations. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk on Thursday welcomed the Security Council call for pauses in the fighting in Gaza, where doctors operate on screaming children without anesthetic, using mobile phones for light. The UN Rights Chief also appealed directly to the warring sides to lay down their weapons. Here he is speaking to journalists in Geneva.
There must also be a ceasefire based on humanitarian and human rights grounds. There needs to be an end to the fighting, not only to deliver the urgently needed basic necessities of life, electricity, water, fuel, and so forth, but also to create the political space for a path out of this horror.
The Security Council passed a resolution Wednesday urging the immediate release of all hostages held by Hamas and for extended humanitarian pauses and corridors throughout the enclave. Mr. Turk stressed that attacks directed at hospitals, schools, markets, and bakeries, as well as collective punishment in the case of Israel's blockade and siege imposed on Gaza, are prohibited under international humanitarian law. So too is aiming indiscriminate projectiles into southern Israel by Palestinian armed groups, hostage taking, and the use of civilians to shield locations from military operations. I am on the side of every civilian, Palestinian or Israeli, who is harmed or who lives in fear, he said. In drought and conflict-affected Ethiopia, the UN World Food Programme, WFP, said on Thursday that it was restarting food assistance after a thorough review of its operations following reports of large-scale aid diversion earlier this year. WFP food aid in the country, which was suspended in June, will aim to reach 3.2 million people after the relaunch. WFP Chief Cindy McCain said that the agency's teams and partners have been working around the clock to get to this point. The UN agency's new approach will rely on reinforced tracking to follow food movements from warehouses to beneficiaries, and a system of community feedback to help report misuse. WFP said that it had successfully tested the new systems in Ethiopia's Tigray province and will now roll them out in Afar, Amhara, and Somali regions. Last month, WFP resumed food assistance to nearly 900,000 refugees in camps across Ethiopia, including some 35,000 people who have fled the conflict in Sudan in recent months. Young people in the Arab world should keep up the fight for climate action, especially in the face of wars and violence raging in the region. That's the message from Nisreen Essaim, a climate activist from Sudan who took the floor at the UN in Geneva on Thursday, having seen firsthand how climate change drives hunger, displacement, and conflict. She told UN News about her advocacy for increased investment in renewable energy as a strategy for sustainability and peace at a time of increased competition for natural resources. She also highlighted the key role of youth in climate adaptation and preparedness and stressed that more scientific education is needed to help young people understand the issues and get involved. Despite only being in her 20s, Nisreen has already gained experience in international advocacy as the chair of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change. She shared the stage at the UN in Geneva on Thursday as part of the Young Activists Summit with four other outstanding campaigners from Burkina Faso, Colombia, India, and Myanmar, working to build peace in the Sahel, protect the environment, end child marriage, and realize the rights of the Rohingya people. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Yep. The world is in turmoil, and violent extremists on all sides are having a bloody feast right now, and we're neck deep. Our government is neck deep in it, providing the weapons to kill people all over the world. It's got to stop. Friends, it's got to stop. This is with Ray McGovern on Dialogue Works, originally aired November 7th. Listen to Ray.
Let's get started with the U.S. foreign policy in Israel. Antony Blinken, in his last meeting with Mahmoud Abbas, said that they are considering two-state solution. If that's the case, why we haven't seen anything coming from the U.S. foreign policy for many years to facilitate this two-state solution, or even convince the Netanyahu administration to accept it as a viable option, viable choice?
Well, Nima, it's not U.S. foreign policy that counts. It's Israeli internal policy. The U.S. does what Israel wants. It's a scandal. Even as recently as this morning, Blinken said, Israel has told us that a ceasefire wouldn't be a good idea, and so we agree. Israel has told us? Now, the whole business about two-state solution is bankrupt. You know, people keep giving it, keep mouthing it as though it's a solution. But, you know, if democracy counts, if one vote counts as much as another, there should be one Palestine. Should the Jews be expelled? Of course not. They should be able to stay, but they should have one vote for each person. So should the Palestinians. I mean, that's basic to democracy. Now, if the Israelis need to share power, well, so be it. They're intruders to begin with. The Palestinians were there before they were. Let's right that wrong, and let's not beat about the bush about so-called two-state solutions. It's one country. The Israelis are there. No one wants to expel them except the most rabid anti-Israeli people. But let them stay. Let them participate in a democracy. Now, why do the Israelis not want that? Well, I mean, hello. They like to have all the votes, right? They have to like to suppress the Palestinians. And their great fear is that if that happens, the Palestinians would not only have as much votes as the Israelis, but eventually they would have more since their birth rate is much higher. So, if we want to talk about democracies, let's put one in there. We can give some guarantees that Israel will not be pushed into the sea. They're not going to be pushed into the sea in any case. But let's not beat around the bush with these so-called two-state solutions. It's one territory of Palestine. Intruders came in there 75 years ago. They've been allowed to work their will on the original inhabitants of that area. Now, let's finally get together and come to an equitable solution, a solution that I dare say is very consonant with the Abrahamic tradition of justice. Not only the Hebrew Bibles read correctly, the Christian scriptures and the Quran. First and foremost, do justice, okay? There are injustice run rampant for the last 75 years. Even people as prominent as Robert Kennedy don't seem to get that, you know? I mean, they've been mouthing the Israeli line. They've been, you've been brainwashed the same way that George W. Bush was brainwashed. Now, why do I say that? Well, very rarely do you get a former national security advisor, in this case, General Brent Scowcroft, saying that George W. Bush, the current president under Scowcroft, who was leading a very prestigious panel, has been brainwashed. He's been wrapped around the little finger of Ariel Sharon. When did he say those things? Right before Iraq, right before the attack on Iraq. And then right after the attack on Iraq, of course, he was dismissed from his prestigious job. But Scowcroft is the epitome of discretion when talking to the press. And he told that the Financial Times, they published it. Nobody else did. And there's a story on that as well.
Why the Israelis are totally against ceasefire or even a humanitarian pause? Do they have any long-term strategy on their part? Because it seems that what's going on right now in Israel doesn't help Israel considering long-term strategy.
A long-term strategy is not uppermost in anyone's mind in Tel Aviv, particularly among the rulers. Netanyahu is engaged in genocide. Let's not blanch before the use of that word. By openly declared statements by Netanyahu, his president, other high officials in his administration, it's genocide, okay? Now, why does he want to do that? Well, he thinks he might be able, with the support of people like Tony Blinken, they might be able to clean out Gaza of all those Palestinians. After all, there are only 2.3 million of them. I jest, of course, when I say only. There was a plan. Blinken was in on it. They're going to drive all those Gazans out through southern Gaza and put them in the Sinai, put them in tent camps and then you know, relocate them, drive them from their homes. And Blinken broached that to the Egyptian president, al-Sisi. You could see how al-Sisi reacted. Why? Al-Sisi was very rude to Blinken. So were the Saudis. So were the Jordanians. So were the other Arab leaders, even the Turkish. You know, the Turkish wouldn't even have a press conference with them yesterday. So Blinken has got blinders on, no pun intended, and he's ruling the roost. In my view, our president does have very much to say. He's not very compassmentous. He's thrown open this door to Zionists like Blinken, Sullivan, Nuland, you know, the new new deputy secretary of state, who's, you know, just as crazy as the others, he with respect to China. The store has been sold out, and they're ruling the roost. Now, what happens when they clash with reality? What happens when the Israelis cannot mistake the fact that they really are alone here, because they got Hezbollah up on top in the north. They've got Iranian supporters and so forth. You know, the Israelis have to recognize that it's different from the way it was 20, 30 years ago. Very different. They are isolated, and they're thinking that, well, we can't be isolated because the United States is with us. That's bad thinking, because the United States is also isolated. Now, what happens when the G7 gets together? It was just this morning we got the announcement. Oh, well, they would favor maybe a temporary pause in a temporary pause in the genocide. I mean, does that sound a little strange, Stu Nima? A temporary pause in the genocide. And Netanyahu says, well, maybe, you know, for an hour or two here or there to let some stuff in, an hour or two, but no ceasefire. Blinken says, well, the Israelis say no ceasefire. That's what they told us. And we agree. I mean, it's really ridiculous. Now, what's going to happen? Well, what's going to happen can't be deciphered very clearly for one very, very important reason. And that is that Netanyahu has a personal stake in what happens. Okay. You know, it's sort of like, well, I won't draw an analogy right now, but there is an analogy to be drawn between Netanyahu on the one hand and Biden on the other. Netanyahu is very likely to be put in prison if he doesn't stay as a ruler of Israel. Why? Because they've got the goods on him, all kinds of corruption. So when I talk about a personal incentive, I mean, that's a big one, okay? And very often, historically, personal incentives plus the outrage on the part of Israeli citizens, most of them, with respect to the Hamas attack on October 7th, that's enough to keep this thing going unless and until the U.S. makes some intervention and says, no, forget it. We've got to have at least a ceasefire for a certain period of time. We've got to do that, BB. Now, the chances of that happening, well, if Biden were awake and compassmentous, he would see that that's the only reasonable outcome here, particularly with Netanyahu's personal stake in this. But he's not awake and he's not compassmentous. And there's this. Biden, too, has a personal stake in not having major losses like what's inevitably going to happen in Gaza and also in Ukraine. Why do I say that? Well, they've got the goods on Biden, too. I mean, court testimony, concrete documents showing they took bribery, that his son and he were involved with the Chinese and the Ukrainians and everybody, a lot of people. And so will he be impeached? I don't know about him. If he loses power, what happens? Well, if that redheaded guy comes in that was president for 4 years, he's a pretty vengeful person. I would not put them past it, not to use the same court procedures to put Biden and Sullivan and Hunter and Blinken in jail for cause. Blinken, of course, coming up with that bizarre story that Hunter's laptop was a Russian intelligence disinformation operation. Okay. And asking a former head of the CIA to round up the usual suspects. Oh, maybe get out 50 former intelligence directors and have them say that his laptop story is a Russian intelligence misinformation, disinformation operation. Now, did Mikey Morrell say, okay, Tony, sure, we can do that? Yes. How long did it take him? 3 days. How many did he get? 50. And then he added Mikey Morrell, so there were 51. Now, why do I say that? Well, there's no way to tell whether that bent the electorate in favor of Biden and escaped a lot of criticism because the election is over. But here's what happened. 3 days after that, Trump, Biden had their last debate. And Trump mentioned this scurrilous, this awful laptop. And he said, you know, what about that? It shows all kinds of crazy stuff, not only on Hunter's part, but on your part, Mr. Biden. What do you say to that? And Joe Biden said, oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, Mr. Trump. Don't you know that 50 former intelligence directors, including 4 former CIA directors, have said that that's just a Russian intelligence disinformation operation? Don't you know that? No. What was Trump to say, you know? So this was the last TV debate. Did that have an influence on the election? I imagine it did. How much? I just don't know. But, you know, this is what it comes down to, this kind of deceptive thing. And, you know, last little comment on this. Did any of those 51 former intelligence directors think to go to the FBI and say, hey, FBI, you've had that laptop for many months now. Tell me, do you think it's a Russian intelligence disinformation operation? What is there evidence there, or does it have any earmarks of that? None of them did that, and isn't that telling? So the whole system was very corrupt. They didn't want Trump to win, and of course, whether they made the difference or not, it's on the books. My point, of course, is that Blinken, by testimony by Mikey Morrell, former acting director of the CIA, before Congress, he said, well, Blinken called me up and asked me to do this, and that's why I did it. So it's on the record. So would Blinken end up in jail? Well, in my view, he should. That has to be against the law, okay? Will he? Well, he can't be sure he can avoid jail if they lose out in the Middle East. And even more if they lose out in Ukraine and then they lose the election. So the stakes are very high for these people who have a personal stake as well as an ideological, nonsensical view that God is a real estate agent. And 75 years ago, he said, look, Israel, we're going to create Israel in this land. And hello, that's not in the Bible. Not the Bible that I know. There's lots else in the Bible. Most of it has to do with doing justice, and that's the Hebrew Bible, as well as the Christian Bible and the Quran. It's the only thing, the only stream that comes straight through the others. Take care of the orphan, the refugee, the widow, okay? That's what we do. The old Hebrew Bibles, the Aramaic was the Anawim. The Anawim, which meant the hated, detested poor, the poor that you saw outside the synagogues, and maybe you threw a kopeck in there, okay? That's what we're supposed to give favor to. And that's very much against what's going on here, both by the Israeli leaders, by the U.S. leaders, and wonder of wonders, I think the people in Iran and other representatives of the other Muslim faith countries sort of think that's a priority and are going to keep their powder dry to make sure that this time Israel doesn't work its will on Gaza. We'll have to see how that comes out, but there's a lot behind all this stuff, and some of this stuff is really kind of beyond the pale. Let me mention one other thing, Nima. I was trying to get Americans sensitized to the fact that, you know, terrorism is bad, right? Yeah. Now, in my view, genocide is worse. Okay. But I agree. Terrorism is bad. What Hamas did on the 7th of October was really, really bad. Okay. Whether they were provoked into doing that or not is another question, but it was bad. Okay. Now, how about terrorism in our country? Oh, actually, on the 11th of September 2001, there was a really big terrorist act. Okay. Now, when that terrorist act called 9/11 took place, there was one and only one prestigious board that took note of it, in the sense that they tried to explain it. I mean, and more than just saying terrorists are bad, we're going to get them, okay? To explain it. And oddly enough, it was an appointed board by the leaders of the Pentagon. It was called the Defense Science Board, okay? And before the election in 2004, where Bush was running for re-election, they produced this paper. The date was September 23, 2004. It's so pregnant with meaning, I'd like to read just three sentences from it, if that's okay. Okay.
Okay.
I fished it out of my archives because I thought it was so relevant I might mention it. September 23, before the November 2 elections, Defense Science Board unanimous opinion, quote, Muslims did not, quote, hate our freedom, end quote, which is what Bush and Cheney were saying. Rather, they hate our policies. The overwhelming majority voiced their objections to what they see as one-sided support in favor of Israel and against Palestinian rights, and the longstanding, even increasing support for what Muslims collectively see as tyrannies, most notably in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Pakistan, and the Gulf states. Thus, when American public diplomacy talks about bringing democracy to Islamic societies, this is seen as no more than self-serving hypocrisy. One more sentence. Nor can the most carefully crafted messages, themes, and words persuade when the messenger lacks credibility, period, end quote. My God, from the Defense Science Board. Now, that happened right before the election, where Bush won another term despite what he had done in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere, okay? So what did the New York Times do? What they always do. They didn't report this Defense Science Board conclusion. And then it got a little too embarrassing because others, like me, started to report it, okay? And so they waited, and then, lo and behold, right after the election, to the election, the Times reported this Defense Science Board conclusions. But they abridged the story. Now, if you remember what I just read, here's how they abridged it. They quoted, quote, Muslims do not hate our freedom. Wait a second. The next sentence was, one-sided support in favor of Israel and against Palestinian rights is what they hate. Oh, Times dropped that out. The Times dropped that out. Now, it wasn't just an editing thing to shorten it. No, they had the earlier sentence, and they had the later sentence. They included the sentence right after it. So it was surgically removed. What was surgically removed? One-sided U.S. support in favor of Israel and against Palestinian rights. Well, okay, the election was won by Bush. It was okay to comment on this, but still be pretty careful not to mention that Israeli policies, and more importantly, the U.S. total identification with the Israeli policies was what gets a lot of Muslims very, very angry. Now, just to continue in this vein, because it's so relevant, Osama bin Laden, what did he say about this? You know, to the degree you think he had some responsibility for 9/11, would be kind of interesting to find out, right? Okay, so the Times has a really long story in late October 2004, but the Times saw that they would relegate to paragraph 23 and 25, the very bottom of the important part of what Osama bin Laden said. Buried there and dwarfed by a large advertisement for Bloomingdale's department store, was bin Laden's revealing claim that the idea for 9/11 first germinated, quote, when we witnessed the oppression and the tyranny of the American-Israeli coalition against our people in Palestine and Lebanon. Now, finally, if one were to look for even more context here, look to page 147 of the 9/11 Commission report. It's very telling. They had caught Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11. And the report was still being written. And I know some people who are working at commission, staff people, and say, oh my God, we got him. Go ask him why he did it. Yeah, we're supposed to find out why. Well, the CIA said, no, you can't ask him. We'll ask him, okay? And still, the CIA came back with this answer. It wasn't because of some slight that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed suffered at the hands of bigots in Greensboro, North Carolina, from which he has a engineering degree, University of North Carolina, Greensboro. It wasn't that he had an affair of the heart that went bad or that some of his co-students called him a towelhead. It wasn't that. Here's how that page 147 of the 9/11 Commission report reads. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, mastermind and executioner of the 9/11 attacks, was motivated by, quote, his violent disagreement with U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. But that was news not fit to print, and so it was downplayed or put on paragraph 23 or 25. Now, when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was rounded up, it was revealed that his nephew was the fellow who tried to down the 9/11 buildings in 1993, okay? His nephew. And what did his nephew say when he was rounded up? He said, I am proud to be rounded up for speaking out and acting out against U.S. foreign policy favoring Israel. Give me 154 years in a maximum security prison. I'm glad. I'm proud of what I did. Now, let's back up here. Do you need any further proof that terrorism is engendered by policy and specifically by U.S. very tight identification with Israel, as Joe Biden and Tony Blinken have now done yet again? Now, it's a little myopic to say, hey, Americans, remember this? There's going to be more terrorism here. You know, 9/11 happened. more is going to happen if you continue this policy. Now, that's tactically sound because you want to wake up Americans, but it's a justice issue. It's a matter of giving the Palestinians their rightful place, to live. And as I say, it's been 75 years and counting. And lastly, 75 years. Whoa, that means I was nine years old when Israel got its own state. And I lived in New York City. And was rejoicing Israel. Peace. No one told me. No one told me that there were people already there. No one told me that 750,000 people were expelled from that land. And for people like Bobby Kennedy to say at that point in time, there were only about 390,000 Palestinians there, is a bald-faced lie. May have been that many after 750,000 were expelled and ended up in places like Gaza and Jordan and surrounding areas. But there were over a million Palestinians there. And now there are as many Palestinians living in the occupied territories as there are Israelis. Taking us back to this so-called two-state solution, never going to work unless somebody new comes in Israel and says, okay, we can't do this anymore. Democracy, well, let's try it. You know, let's try it. Let's consider Gazans, people in the West Bank, you know, let's consider them, can we say equal? Let's consider them equal. Let's have a democracy. If we have to share power, so be it. That's not going to happen unless there's a new government in Israel and a new support by this blindsided U.S. administration, which does not have to give 110 support to what's going on right now. Call it genocide because it's a model of the definition of genocide. People should be upset by that, don't you think, Nima?
This conflict in Israel, in Gaza, it seems that is unifying Sunni and Shia. We have Turkey. This country is so important for NATO and for Israel because 40% of the oil that goes to Israel comes from Azerbaijan, goes through Turkey. How do you see the possibility of Turkey getting involved in Gaza?
Well, you asked the right question, Nima, as usual. Starting out with the notion that Shia and Sunni are united for the first time on a major deal for a long time, okay? That means something. That means Iran, Shia, Turkey, Sunni, Saudi Arabia to a degree, Sunni. Ironically, Sunni. Oh, my God. So you've got all these people watching what's going on. They don't like it, not one bit. What are they going to do about it? Well, they're going to be very rhetorically acrimonious, which is what Erdogan has been doing. They're going to be perspicacious, in my view. Neither Turkey nor Iran want to get involved in a war with the United States. Okay, they don't even want to risk that. Unless it's absolutely unavoidable. It's avoidable. You mentioned the gas and oil that is provided to Israel. I mean, this all happened before, right? 1973, the oil weapon. You know, I remember waiting in line to fill up my gas tank in my car. It took me 2 hours, and I could only get 10 gallons, and they each cost $12, okay? Do we want that again? Is that what Biden wants right before the reelection? So they have, what I'm saying, they have economic weapons and they have patience, if only because they don't want to get in war with the United States. Now, that sounds unlikely, but they know, as you know, Nima, and as I know, that there are people running U.S. foreign policy that would be just delighted to get into a war with Iran. Just delighted. The Iranians are pretty smart people. They see that. They know that. They're going to do everything they can, short of war, to support what's going on in Palestine. But my view is that they're smart enough to avoid open hostilities. Austin, what's his name? Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, when he testifies before Congress that Israel couldn't make it without our help. They need our help. Yeah, right. Okay. Like Ukraine. Okay. Well, Ukraine's not going to get much more of our help. Israel, well, that remains to be seen, you know? Remains to be seen. Will Blinken be so discredited? Will Biden have to find some way out of this? That remains to be seen. Meanwhile, as I see Turkey, Iran, and the surrounding Arab countries, they're keeping their powder dry. They're helping people who are trying to help the Palestinians. Whether they're encouraging raids or on U.S. bases in Syria and Iraq, I don't know. They certainly have supported those terrorists in the past. Those are the bad terrorists. Now, get this straight. We support the good terrorists in Syria and Iraq. So anyhow, the bad terrorists, yeah, they've been supported. But now whether Tehran says, okay, now I want you to hit this U.S. base in Iraq next Sunday, I don't think that's the case. They have the wherewithal. They have their own initiative. They just go ahead and do it. Now, what happens when 100 of those 1,000 U.S. troops up in the northern part of Syria gets killed? Okay. Well, 1,000 U.S. troops, 900 maybe, but in the northern part, what were they doing there? Oh, that's right. President Trump said, they're there to steal the oil, to steal the oil, his words. Hello? Okay. Were they invited by Bashar al-Assad, the president? Said, no, they weren't. How about the troops down in the eastern pocket of Syria who are training the moderate terrorists? What about them? Well, they weren't invited either. So, you know, if those people get hit, well, people start asking, what the hell were they doing in Syria anyhow? And did Congress authorize this? And of course, the answer to that is no. Would Congress wake up? I don't know. But, you know, we need to challenge them. So these people get hit. How is the U.S. going to react? Well, they'll send bombers, and then they'll try to kill the terrorists. It'll be a kind of a whack-a-mole sort of thing. There are terrorists here, there are terrorists there. It's not going to make much difference. So we have a very volatile situation. And what the world is waiting for is for example, those G7 leaders who couldn't persuade Tony Blinken to go for a ceasefire. Why? Well, in Blinken's words, the Israelis say we shouldn't do that, and the Israelis tell us that it's not a good idea, and so we agree completely. I mean, unless that changes, this thing is going to go on to the point where Erdogan, the Iranians, would be sorely tempted to give even more support to the Palestinians. We'll have to see. I don't know how it's going to come out. They have the wherewithal. There's a wild card here, Nima, which needs to be mentioned and never is. And that is that Israel has a nuclear weapon. Most people say they have between 90 and 200 warheads. Okay. Now, would the Israeli leaders resort to that in extremis? My view is, yes, they would. And so what does that mean? That injects a really important aspect into this whole thing. My hope is that that ballistic missile submarine now in the area, which has cruise missile capabilities as well, if memory serves, and the armada, the two aircraft carriers that are there, they are telling Netanyahu, look, we got you covered, you know? Don't even think about using your nuclear weapons, okay? There's one crazy minister in the Israeli government that 3 days ago said, yeah, maybe we'll use a small nuke to obliterate Gaza, okay? Now, immediately, the rest of the Israelis said, well, no, that's not a good idea, and please don't talk anymore. But the guy's still a minister. What does that tell you? Okay. So my hope is that in addition to trying to provoke, frankly, Iran into open hostilities, some of the people in Washington really want that. Okay. In addition to that, we're saying to the Israelis, look, we know you have these small little nukes. We tested them for you. That's my view, at least. So we know you got them, but we got you covered. Don't even think about using those nukes. Look, we have this ballistic missile submarine, Ohio class, with all manager, and we got these two aircraft. Please, baby, don't think about using your nuclear weapon. Now, that's a benign thought about why those aircraft carriers and that ballistic missile submarine are there, but I kind of think that that may be part of it. And if so, so much the good in terms of U.S. policy. For God's sake, we wouldn't want the Israelis to resort to these nuclear capabilities. We don't even want to acknowledge that they have one, because, and I'll stop with this, Nima, what happens knowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons? Well, we can't give them any more weapons aid. We can't send them any more arms. Why? Because there's a law passed in the U.S. Congress decades ago that says any country that develops a nuclear capability outside the Non-Proliferation Treaty cannot be given U.S. weapons support. It's on the books. So that's why we can't acknowledge officially that they have nuclear weapons. Colin Powell has said it, sure, after he left office. Some Israeli premiers have said it. It's no secret. It's just that because of juridical or legislative considerations, it's very delicate, and U.S. policymakers can't acknowledge that Israel has these nuclear weapons that we helped develop, and actually some of the technology they stole for us, and Bibi Netanyahu helped in that operation. They have this, but they can't acknowledge it, because otherwise we couldn't give them $3 billion, like with a B, arms aid every year. So people have to come to their senses, and Hamas, Gaza is not going to be the same in the future. We have to kind of figure out how to persuade people that fair is fair. One state is what's needed. Democracy would require equal rights for everybody. People to vote no matter what color they are. And that's a big aspect here, you know, racism, pure and simple. I mean, even the Ukrainians talking about the Russians being less than human. And of course, we have similar statements from Netanyahu and company about the Palestinians. So we're going to face into this thing. We have to be very forward and very open and very explicit in saying, this has got to stop. Hamas, you know, when we say that Putin was unprovoked in going into Ukraine, well, most people realize quite right, was Hamas unprovoked in going into southern Israel? I don't think so. They were provoked over the previous 75 years.
Ray, you talk about these nuclear bombs of Israel. It seems that it's some kind of upper hand for Israel in that region. Do you think that these nuclear bombs gonna make Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia getting more serious and going after getting nuclear bombs?
Well, I think in a general sense, that would be the background here. But I'd like to focus just on the immediate future. And the reality is that Israel is already deterred, despite the fact that Iran, by public policy, has no nuclear warhead to put on their missiles, okay? There's a fatwa against that, right? Now, how about Turkey? Well, Turkey would like to have one. So would Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is hoping to get some help from the United States in developing this kind of capability. So the wish is always there. The immediate requirements do not require it, because not only Iran, but Hezbollah, they have thousands of missiles that could rain down on this little country in Israel and demolish it. So the Israelis are already deterred in a very real sense, but this is not to rule out the notion that Bibi Netanyahu, in a sort of Samson-like atmosphere, would pull the temple down upon him, since he's going to go to jail anyway, you know? It's very, 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 very volatile is the word. And the Iranians know that, so do the Turks and the Arab countries surrounding Israel. The future does not look good for Bibi Netanyahu, no matter what happens. But his incentive right now is to keep this thing going. And if the U.S. lets him, this genocide will continue. Now, I'm reminded that there was a genocide during my early years. I was alive for all of World War II. And 6 million Jews, which is the figure that's usually given, well, that's genocide. Now, there are 2.3 Gazans. 2 million, 2 million not enough? Is that not genocide? Well, the law is very clear. The law forbids what Israel is doing, what it's doing in an openly declared way. And the law is very clear that you don't have to kill all of them. You can just kill a major part of people because of their ethnicity. And that's a war crime. That's genocide. And more people, and especially the new emerging people in the global south, are incensed at what's going on here. You know, on Ukraine, we know that the U.S. had to veto. Actually, that was, you know, it was on Gaza for a ceasefire. They were the single country vetoing the resolution for a ceasefire. Well, you know, for the U.S. to claim that it is indispensable and exceptional in the world, well, in one strange sense, that's true now. They're out of the mainstream. They're a minority in the world. They're isolated in their exclusivity. And the worst thing, Nima, is they don't seem to understand that. These guys, Blinken, Sullivan, Nuland, they all went to the best schools. They were all told that they could do no wrong, that the U.S. can reign supreme. And they still don't get it through their heads that they're not indispensable. The president himself, 2 weeks ago in a major speech, said, we're the indispensable country of the world. And he quoted Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State for Bill Clinton, who famously said, when asked by, what was her name, one of the prominent correspondents, Leslie Stahl was her name, interview, Madam Secretary, 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 are dead now because of the sanctions you put in against the Saddam Hussein regime. Do you think that's worth it? Madeline Albright, yes, that's worth it. And we all agree that's worth it. My God, okay? So what's the point? Is President Joe Biden, 2023, decades later, quoting the unconscionable remarks of Madeleine Albright saying a 500,000 Iraqi children under the age of 5 dead is worth it? Well, you know, he lives in a different world, and Blinken lives in the same world. It really will depend on us. You know, we have really mounted some major demonstrations over just last Saturday. American people need to speak out. And now is the time to do that before worse things happen, not only in Gaza, but also in Ukraine, where the Ukrainians are almost literally down to the last Ukrainian fighter in that terrible conflict.
Recently, Time magazine published an article about Zelensky saying that Zelensky is so delusional about what's going on in Ukraine. Who made Zelensky delusional? Because this was a comedian with no experience, came out of nowhere, and right now he's doubling down on his failure in Ukraine. On the other hand, we have Lloyd Austin asking at the Senate, asking for weapons, money to be sent to Ukraine. This policy is making Zelensky less delusional, more delusional. How do you find this kind of policy and the state of mind of Zelensky right now?
Well, that Time magazine cover article was very illuminating. Zelensky is delusional. The comparison, of course, is to Hitler in the bunker as the Allied forces approached Berlin. Actually, it was the Soviet forces approached Berlin. And so what does that mean? Well, Zelensky is less delusional. You know, it's kind of no play on words here, but it's Zelensky who's delusional. Zelensky is a little bit more level-headed, and he made the mistake of saying to The Economist, you know, the war's at a stalemate. We have to kind of figure out what to do, you know. Well, it's not really at a stalemate. The Russians have won the war, okay? But let's take stalemate. It's still what are we going to do, okay? Now, Zelensky took off. That's terrible. No stalemate. I don't think it's a stalemate. And what I say goes, becomes a president. Besides, we're not going to have any elections anytime soon. Talk about democracy, right? Now, somebody sends Zelensky a live grenade. Now, who did that, I wonder? I don't know. But it went off and killed one of his most important supporters. Things are happening in Ukraine at a pretty fast pace now. Zelensky, despite his delusions or illusions of grandeur, is not long for this world. I don't know how they get rid of him. I mean, they've created a monster. And Scott Ritter, my good friend, has a really good couple of videos showing exactly who put Zelensky in power, okay? The oligarchs that were involved and the fact that, you know, he's been on somebody's strings all the time. What are his assets? He's a terrific actor. That gets him in front of Congress. It lets him present a Ukrainian flag from Bakhmut to the Speaker of the House and the Vice President. Now, they don't let him anywhere near a combined session of Congress. So the poor guy has been taken for a ride. Now, he probably has a couple of villas spread around the world. So he and his pretty wife can go there anytime they like. The question is, will they be allowed to go? Because once gone, he's free to spill the beans about what really went down here. So I don't think my guess is that the Ukrainians are such folks that Zelensky really ought to take out more life insurance if he can get it, because I don't think he's very long for this world. And I say that advisedly.
Do you see any change in the Biden administration's policy in Ukraine? Are they going to pressure Zelensky to go after negotiations?
There are reports. NBC was one source saying, yeah, U.S. officials, unnamed officials, say, yeah, we're pressing Zelensky and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, Zelensky is between a rock and a hard place. There are the neo-Nazis, the Azov battalion folks, okay? They're not gonna go down easily. They're not gonna allow him to do some of the things he could sensibly do now. He himself seems pretty delusional. So who are the U.S. going to get to negotiate with the Russians? Well, the time has come, I think, for the U.S. to pick somebody else. My candidate would be Zelensky, who is less delusional. Okay. If he escapes assassination, as he successfully did just yesterday, then he would be a natural person to put in there. He actually has a pretty good reputation as a warrior, as a general who knows up from down, although the advice he's been getting from NATO hasn't been very helpful in helping Ukraine to make advances. So I would think that maybe a military leader who has already made the point that we ought to recognize a stalemate and stop and figure out what to do now would be the most logical successor. But then what do you do with Zelensky? And how do you get these people to talk to the Russians? Well, Zelensky could. He's held in high regard in Russian and military circles. He studied at Russian military schools, if memory serves. There are all kinds of possibilities. There is a fraternal relationship between some Ukrainians and the Russian leaders. Zelensky would be one that would come foremost to mind. How they get rid of Zelensky, well, maybe they can put him on some island like Alba, like Napoleon. What did they name it? And maybe find another Alba, or he can go to one of the haciendas that he is reported to have already paid for, and maybe there's some way they could keep him silent. They can't depend on that, though, and neither can the Ukrainians. So, as again, I would suggest for them to take a little bit more life insurance out.
From Chuck Schumer to Mitch McConnell, they all were united using Ukraine to defeat Russia and sending a strong message to China. It seems that we are at the final stages of this war in Ukraine. What message has been sent to China, in your opinion?
The message, if I were Xi Jinping, I would be thinking, well, these guys are delusional. They still think that they're the indispensable, exceptional country in the world. My God, they're very dangerous. They're picking a fight with us when we have said for years and throughout our millennia of history, can't we just get along? Can't we do a 1-1 sort of thing, a win-win rather than a win-lose? You said that Taiwan was part of China. Why are you reneging on that now? Why are you filling Taiwan with weaponry from the U.S.? We don't understand that, but we're not going to stand for it. So what I'm saying is that I think Xi Jinping, helped by Wang He, the foreign minister and member of the ruling Politburo in Beijing, are just kind of scratching their heads now. And the immediate decision, and this is really interesting, the immediate decision is, should President Xi go to San Francisco for the APEC summit meeting? I just said 2 weeks, I think it is, later this month. Should he go or not? Now, under ordinary circumstances, of course he would go. I mean, even though he would, you know, he might even welcome meeting with Biden and just taking stock of his state of mind, maybe having a little conversation with him and saying, do you know what 2 plus 2 is, Joe? And see if he knows that it's four, not five. But, you know, the atmosphere has been so poisoned. And the fact that not even military to military communications have been reestablished, despite Wang Yi for 3 days in Washington, they've talked about strategic weapons, and that's good. But so, I don't know. I thought that since Wang Yi's visit to Washington, and there was no indication that Xi Jinping would go to San Francisco, I thought, well, that plus U.S. support for Israel in Gaza, he probably won't go. But you could look at it another way and say, well, you know, here is an opportunity for Xi to meet not only with Biden, but with others. He really might see that the balance is that maybe he would go. So it's going to be interesting because there's not much time left, and the Chinese are playing it really, really cool as to whether he'll go or not. I'm prepared to be surprised if he does go, because I think he might just use this opportunity to show the disdain in which he holds Biden, Blinken, and the rest of that crew.
How do you see the future of NATO, considering what's going on, what has happened in Ukraine, and what's going on in Israel? Two new members joining NATO, Finland and Sweden. A strong disagreement on what's going on in Gaza between Turkey and the other members of NATO, especially the U.S. When you take into account all these events together, how do you see the future of NATO?
Well, let's start out with the realization that Turkey has the most potent military force, bar none in NATO, at least as far as Europe is concerned. The U.S., large scheme of things, has probably better. So NATO has been depending on Turkey to defend against whom, Nima? Russia? Give me a break. You know, what people need to do is divest themselves from this notion that Russia has been a threat to the West, to NATO, for the last 30 years. Count them, 30 years, okay? The Soviet Union fell apart. Pass it around. The Soviet Union fell apart, right? Okay? Now, Putin, over the last 20 years, has been able to reestablish the Russian military and the economy, and has made Russia survive, okay? What does that mean for NATO? Well, NATO is an archaic kind of vestigial organ, if I may. It's really the U.S., and the U.S. is itself falling apart. I mean, there's one concrete symbol of all this that I like to adduce. When I was training as an Army Infantry Intelligence Officer at Fort Benning, the Army Infantry School, we trained with 155 millimeter howitzers, self-propelled 105 millimeter not self-propelled gun. They all use the 155 millimeter shell, okay? That was part of the deterrent against the Soviet Union. Now, what happened? We've run out of them. And we have naive people saying, you know, the Ukraine can still match Russia and defend itself if they don't run out of ammunition. Well, you know, I like to tell those folks, hey, they're running out of ammunition. Now, this became apparent about 3 months ago, and I can see the scenario here. Blinken, Austin, Sullivan, and the president. And the president says, hey, I hear that the Ukraine's running out of 155 millimeter shells, what they need. Is that true? Yeah, that's true, sir. Well, let's give them some of ours. Well, sir, we've already given them a whole bunch. Well, they shoot them off. I mean, we'll give them some more. Oh, we can't, sir, because we're low. We're low ourselves. So what are we going to do? Well, we have these these munitions that scatter all around here, they're not really, they're disapproved by 110 other countries, but we give them, okay, give them, okay. Well, we could run out of those as well. Well, let's give them depleted uranium shells for our tanks and so forth. Okay, well, I do. Now, when we run out of those, is it possible that we would resort to a tactical mini nuke? Well, let's take that up in just a second. Let's just finish with this running out of 155 millimeter shells, all right? Now, if Russia was a threat to the United States since 1991, we would have lots of 155 millimeter shells, and so would all our European allies. Hello? Why do we not have them? Well, I'll tell you the reason. Because it's a myth. It's a lie that Russia threatened NATO in any real sense until NATO overthrew the duly elected government in Kiev, Ukraine, in February of 2014. So what happened then? Well, NATO thought they had everything under control. These guys were going to do our bidding. And so did they build 155 millimeter shells then? No. Why? Well, because Russia can't do anything to, we don't, there's no real threat from Russia. So I mean, if you look at these things, you would say if Russia was a threat, we would have the necessary to repel them, just as we did back in the 60s and 50s when I was around, 70s, okay? So what about the nukes? What scares me, Nima, is that it's just not a stalemate. This is a loss, President Biden and his retinue. Now, was it about 2 months ago, Biden famously said, Russia has lost in Ukraine. And his CIA chief said, not only that, not has Russia lost, but the ineffectualness, the inability of Russia, if it arms forces to work its will, has just been laid bare to the whole world to see. Okay. Now, we're talking about Zelensky or delusional. I mean, these guys are delusional, right? Okay. So what happens in another month when it becomes clear that Ukraine doesn't have any more men? They're sending women and people my age to the front lines now. Not only no more men, but no more 155 millimeter shells. They're out of ammunition. We scarfed up some, but where did we send them? Israel. Okay, so what am I saying here? I'm saying that Russia has made very clear that they would not use nuclear weapons unless their territory was threatened. And you know, unless somebody used nuclear weapons first. So here are these idiots. And I use my apologies to some of my favorite idiots that I know. Okay, I use the term advisedly for Blinken, Sullivan, and these other people. Okay, what are they going to say to Biden? He's going to say, well, we're out of those scatter shells, right? We're out of those depleted uranium. What else we got? And look up to the shelf up in the top there that has this key on it and say, well, Mr. President, we have the mini nukes we could do. That would put the fear of God on them. So why don't we use a little mini nuke to give Russia a big warning and help Ukraine face this thing down? Now, do I think that's likely? Oh, my God, I pray that it's not. But these guys have surprised me. And as I mentioned to you before, there's a personal incentive not to be shown to having lost the war, losing an election, and in extremis, losing their own freedom for provable lies, provable rules and law violations that are already on the books, some of them already in court. So Russia's not going to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. But they have made it very clear that the U.S. should not think that they could use them without immediate retaliation, and they don't have to retaliate with nuclear weapons. They have these Kinzhal missiles that fly at 9 times the speed of sound. They're called hypersonic, advisedly, okay? And they have warheads that can wreak havoc without any nuclear stuff, okay? So they're already active in the Black Sea, and of course they've been used in Ukraine. They've been tried and tested. They work, and even the President of the United States has admitted there's no defense against them. So I hope that some reasonable people will come around. And that's a hope against hope. You know, I'm trying to avoid despair, okay? Now, one last thing from history here. When Lyndon B. Johnson, the president who succeeded John Kennedy, when he was lied to by a military in Saigon and elsewhere, who told him, oh, we got this made, we got this under control. Those little barefoot black feet in the jungle cannot possibly match the United States of America, which is quintessentially exceptional, okay? Well, guess what? He was misled by Army intelligence into thinking that there were less than 300,000 communists in South Vietnam that were armed, okay? We knew in CIA there were between 500,000 and 600,000. We told our director that was the case. We got everybody in Washington to agree with us because we had the facts and the evidence, and our director said, well, you're right, and Westmoreland is wrong, the general who is running things in Saigon, but, you know, my primary duty here as director of central of the CIA is to protect the agency. And there's no way I can protect the agency if I get involved in a pissing match with the United States Army at war. So you're right, but we're going to tell LBJ that there are only 299,000 Westmoreland's figure. That was August 1967. I was there. I saw it. One of my best friends was responsible for enemy order of battle. What happens? That was August. End of January, the Viet Cong, the communists under arms in South Vietnam, attack every hamlet, town, village, city in South Vietnam with, guess how many troops? 600,000. So that's beginning of February, the end of January, beginning of February 1968. Oh, it's going to be an election year. So what happens? LBJ finally goes and says, oh, you guys were right. You were in the CIA. I'm not going to give Westmoreland any more troops. He's asked me for 210,000 more to go up into North Vietnam and finish him off. I'm not going to do that. Instead of that, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pull out of there, and I'm going to not run a re-election. That was March 1968. All that happened within a few weeks. Why did it happen? Well, because LBJ had some advisors who knew which end was up. Clark Clifford, some of the people at CIA who had been insisting on the higher figure of enemy numbers, and he Council of Wise Men, okay? And they said, look, LBJ, sorry we misled you, but you're not going to win. And besides, Bobby Kennedy's going to come into the race. My God, this is Bobby Kennedy Sr., right? And besides, other people make inroads. It's not at all clear that you're even going to win if you... So LBJ goes on TV on March 31st, 1968, says, I'm not going to run for re-election. We're going to a bombing pause. We're going to work this thing out. We're going to do negotiations. Well, that's my point. The situation is similar now. But there are no wise men. Or wise women. There's no wiseness. There are no people. There's no magi. There's no nothing in Washington that sleepy Joe Biden can listen to or would listen to. We've been trying, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. We've written 5 memos. We veteran intelligence professionals for sanity have written altogether 5 memoranda to President Biden, as we wrote memoranda to all his predecessors, up to and including George W. Bush. We only do about 2 a year, so we wait till very important junctures. But in our latest, which is January of this year, we were just bewildered by what his intelligence officials were telling him. Here was Avril Haines, who's the director of national intelligence, sitting above all the other intelligence agencies. I think there are something like 17 of them now. Okay. And she's saying, oh, I'm really optimistic about the coming counteroffensive by Ukrainians. I'm really looking forward to that. It looks like it's going to be very good. You know why? Because the Russians are running out of ammunition. And besides that, the Russians have no indigenous capability to produce the necessary weapons that they need. So this is going to be really good. Yeah. Now, the head of the CIA said similar things. Now, I mean the rest of veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, who know even more, much more than McGovern does about military realities, and people like Colonel McGregor and others, it was just, hello, what planet do these people live on? The Russians have used the fall and winter to reinforce to a degree that the Ukrainians don't have a prayer of breaching those defenses. And even some leaked Pentagon memorandum show that the Pentagon itself realized that they don't have a prayer of succeeding. Why are they doing this? Okay. And they did it. Okay. What is it? 5 months ago. Is it 5 months? June, whatever it is. Okay. June, July, August. Yeah. Okay. 5 months. 500 meters advance or so in some little town, it doesn't matter. And the Russians are equipped now to roll over them if they decide to do that en masse. Right now, Putin is doing the attrit. I apologize for using a short word, a shortage for attrition, but that's the name of the game, okay? The Russians have been doing this with great success ever since they withdrew in strategic withdrawals last spring before this past one, and harbored their resources, recruited another 250,000-300,000 recruits, and reinforced. So they are ready now to finish off Ukraine. And here is Zelensky saying, no, we're going to win. We're going to win back even Crimea. And Zelensky is saying, no, we haven't lost yet, but it's a stalemate. So what's going to happen? We'll have to see what happens. The most important thing here, and again, I hate to admit this, but Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin has himself said that U.S. foreign policy and U.S. military policy is affected first and foremost by domestic political requirements. That's a virtual quote. He said that a couple of times, okay? So what does that mean? Well, Biden is between a rock and a hard place. He can't afford to lose. He's going to lose unless some deus ex machina appears on the scene. And could that take the, here's a mini nuke. A mini nuke could be a deus ex machina. Now, I don't know if they're even considering that, but I don't have the luxury of saying, maybe they are, maybe they're not. Mr. Biden, not Mr. Biden, Mr. Putin and his generals have to assume that he's considering that. The alternative is to lose the war, lose the election, and perhaps even lose their freedom, as I've talked about before. So that's why you're getting all these warnings from the Russians. That's why Medvedev, the former Russian president, has said, and this goes back 6 months. He says, look, you in the West, you should pray devoutly that we win. Why? Well, because if Russia wins, things will sort out rather peacefully. But if you put us in a position of losing parts of what are now part of Russia, well, that's when you have to worry about a nuclear weapon. Okay. Now, I think chances of that scenario are virtually nil. Russia is not losing, okay? But the other side of the equation, of course, is America, Zelensky, and all those NATO vassal states are losing and losing badly. Some of those governments in those vassal states are going to fall. The Poles are not supplying any more ammunition. The Slovak, the Turks, of course not. And most important, getting back to the Turks, is they saw that this war should have stopped on April 1st, 2022. Okay? Why? Because there was an agreement reached between Zelensky's negotiators and Russian negotiators, that they would come to an understanding that Ukraine would be neutral, that they wouldn't join NATO, and that there would be a codicil talking about the disposition of forces on each side, and that the Russians would withdraw. But what happened? Well, coincidentally with that, the Russians withdrew from around Kiev. Now, some people say that's because they suffered heavy losses. But I don't know about heavy losses. It was part of the deal. Now, what happened? That deal was reached, okay? Initial talks in Belarus earlier in March, and then real serious talks in Istanbul, Turkey, with the participation of leading Turkish officials, okay? So they knew what the deal was, okay? And the deal was reached. It was initialed. Now, that could have ended the whole mess on the 1st of April, 2022. Okay, what happened? Well, Washington told Zelensky, no deal, no deal. You may be willing to negotiate with the Russians. You may be willing not to enter NATO, but we're not. So you do what we tell you. And we're sending our representative, Boris Johnson, the head of the UK, to tell you that personally, just in case you don't believe us. Johnson shows up a couple days later and says, you're right. We don't agree with this. We have to keep the war going. Look, the Russians are losing. Okay? So what does that mean? Well, where do I get that information? I'll tell you where I get it. Ukrainskaya Pravda. Kiev's main newspaper. I mean, there was no doubt as to what happened when Johnson came and how the deal fell through. So you're a Turk, right? And you know this background. You were there. You were involved in it. And so was a former Israeli prime minister who has also made a clean breast of this. And Gerhard Schröder, a former German chancellor, he said the same thing just last week. So the deal was there. It fell apart. And now what are reasonable people like the Turks to think about why this thing keeps dragging on, what NATO's real objectives are, And yeah, the Turks will stay in NATO, but not play any real role. They're pretty much a dissenting force now. Now, NATO? Well, we have the General Secretary of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, okay? He says 3 weeks ago, Putin wanted us to not incorporate Ukraine in NATO, okay? He was a dead set against NATO enlargement. He said that would not be tolerated. Otherwise, we might invade, okay? And we said, we rejected that. And so he invaded. Now, guess what? Instead of less people in NATO, he's got Finland and soon to be Sweden. So he tried to get less people in NATO, and now he has more people in NATO. No, it was really bizarre. He said that in front of the EU Parliament, okay? People were scratching their heads because the story before that was NATO enlargement had nothing to do with Putin's invasion of Ukraine. Nothing, no, didn't have anything to do. So here he is admitting it. So he too has been saying explicitly the Russians said that they would have to invade Ukraine if we didn't forbid them from becoming members of NATO, and we just rejected that. That was in a draft treaty, by the way, given by the Russians to NATO and to the United States in the middle of December 2021. Stoltenberg, we rejected it. Okay, so if people are aware of these details, and most of my American friends are not because of the mainstream media suppressing these details, you can see who is at fault for the carnage, and I use the word advisedly, sacrifice of maybe 400,000 Ukrainian youth in a terrible mistake or something done at the bidding of a comedian, a marionette being worked by the U.S. And why is the U.S. working this? Well, we have the President of the United States saying the idea is to give Russia a, quote, strategic defeat. And we have the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, saying the idea is to weaken Russia. So 500,000 cream of Ukrainian youth dead, so that we could weaken Russia? Well, the supreme irony, of course, is that Russia has become stronger. They're a much more formidable armed adversary to NATO right now than they were before Ukraine. I have no thought that they want to take the Baltic nations or Poland in their next step, but people are saying that, trying to justify what we're doing. So the whole thing is coming apart. And, you can't put the wheels back on the wagon when the wagon is hurtling down the slope or the juggernaut down into the water. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but we're at a historic moment here. And it all has to do with whether there can be wise men or wise women found somewhere in this country that can come in and say, look, Joe Biden, you've been terribly misled by the same kind of people. They were called back in the Vietnam era the best and the brightest. They went to the same schools that Blinken and Sullivan went to. They were given the idea that they were exceptional, and they are exceptional, exceptionally arrogant, truly stupid, and recognize the real balance of forces now, which has turned markedly against them.
That that's it for the – now, that's Ray McGovern. He's got to – I mean, that guy. Yeah, that is from Dialogue Works, November 7, 2023. Now, there are many, many voices, informed people that appear on Dialogue Works. This guy is doing his work. He's doing it real – he's doing a good job. Strongly encourage that you go to YouTube and just search on the YouTube search bar, Dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, space, Works, W-O-R-K-S. And subscribe or just check out the channel. Lots and lots of voices. The guy is doing a great job. My hat tip to him. We've got some special news coming up. We may have a big show Tuesday. It's possible we'll have in anticipation of the December 4th screening and appearance of the 40th anniversary of the making of the movie The Day After, which will be on December 4th and will be appearing at Liberty Hall. And we may have the director of the movie The Day After. Now, we'll see. We're booking. We're seeing how it works out. If it does, then we'll give, we'll see how John Grant handles that. Our Tuesday, this can be happening. Host. All right. Well, I enjoyed listening to Ray today. And we may broadcast another one with Ray through Dialogue Works. He appeared, Ray appeared today, November 16th, yeah, today, on Dialogue Works. I'm not going to broadcast his latest stuff because it's, you know, it's just not, it's not polite. So check out Dialogue Works, and thank you so much for allowing me to use it. I want you to have a good day. It's a great day, and have fun.